It's good. It's being recorded. Hello, is this Amelia?
Hello, this is Denise.
How are you today?
Good, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I guess we're the first ones.
I guess so. Where are you coming from?
New York.
Oh, me too, New York. Where in New York? I'm in Long Island.
Me too, I'm in Roslyn.
Roslyn?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, right? I've had other people from New York, but they're either upstate or from Manhattan. First person from Long Island.
That's wonderful. How do you find anybody from Long Island in this situation?
I know.
This is great. What a beautiful day today, eh?
It is a beautiful day.
It is beautiful, yes.
It's been so cold these past few days.
I know, but today, enjoy today.
Yeah.
And then we'll be complaining about the heat, but anyway.
Yes,
that's nice.
Well, we're from Puerto Rico, so I like the heat.
You are from Puerto Rico?
Uh-huh.
I am from Cuba.
Oh, wow. Hola. Small world. Wow, this is so amazing.
A small world, yes. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Are you taking the other coaching class also, or just
yes,
this one?
No, I'm taking two. I'm taking the certification one.
Yeah, me too.
What time are you taking it?
1 o'clock on Tuesdays.
Oh, I'll take the 9 o'clock on Tuesdays, 9 p.m. 9 p.m.
Who's your instructor?
Dave.
Oh, I have Jennifer.
Yeah, Jennifer. Oh, Jennifer is really nice.
Yeah.
I think. But Dave is amazing. He is like a walking encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
This man is amazing.
Wow.
He is wonderful. Yes, he's really teaching an excellent class.
Wow.
Yeah. Very happy. And then since I am working, I think about transitions, and I saw this is going to be good.
Right, of course.
Have you taken any course with him before?
No, this is my first one with him.
So you're starting, are you already coaching? Or?
Well, I do my practice coaching, but I'm getting my certificate through Jennifer.
Okay, yes. I do practice coaching, but I'm going to do the certificate, yes. I'm getting the certificate. So I'm trying to work on all things because I want to start right away. So,
right.
And I want to work from home. I want to work from home. So I'm
Me
trying
too.
To get my office set up and all the things and see what kind of permits we need here in Long Island.
Right.
I checked with my village today, and I don't need any permits from here or license.
Oh, great. So,
and I don't need anything from Freeport, no. I can go ahead. But I'm going to get the state, and probably Nassau County would ask for something, yeah.
Well, hey, welcome to everybody. This is Day. I apologize for interrupting good gossip here.
Oh, we make friends already here.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Medea.
Hey, thanks.
Hello.
Thanks for all of the emails that you sent and the responses to the questions. Kind words, I appreciate that. A couple of things I hadn't talked about, but want to respond to some of the questions. One is that applies more to our work with clients as mentor coaches than just change and transition itself. Let me ask for a management of the background noise. Even when you shuffle paper, it's picked up. So
yeah, I was going to ask if you have a volume button. Can you turn your volume up, or is that the highest it can?
I will do that. So if each of you will mute until you're ready to talk. Thanks for that mention, too. One is just to keep in mind conversational intelligence. What we know now is that neuroscience research shows that the first word spoken in a conversation triggers a reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset, and that mindset processes the entire remainder of the conversation that determines meaning and significance. For example, a conversation that begins with authoritative or critical or adversarial remarks, or ones that are perceived in that way, activates the defensive circuitry in the listener of fight or flight, and it's mediated by stress chemicals like cortisol and adrenaline. So the listener experiences perhaps a guardedness, maybe a question of trust, and may close down for self-protection in some way. Now, on the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode, which is the framework of our work in mentor coaching, activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system related to bonding and connection. That perception of collaboration and trust induces a desire to listen without judgment, because that neurochemical system processes the entire remainder of the conversation. So that's something to remember, not just when you're talking to your teenage kids, but when you're talking to your clients as well. And that's the framework that we have that is unique to professional coaching. Of all professional relationships, is that of collaboration. We are co-creating a story together based on the client's need, the client's point of reference, to help the client develop that successful story. And every one of those stories will involve change and transformation in some way, which is why we're at the point we do about discussing our topic. We're going to talk today about states of mind. The other thing I wanted to mention, that one of the questions was really excellent, and this is just to think about. The only difference between excitement and fear is what your brain tells you. In other words, excitement and fear register in the same way in your brain. They're exactly the same. So the framework we put around something, the framework in which we understand it and process it, determines how we're going to respond to it. So we respond to it by fear and avoiding pain, or we respond to it to look at it in terms of perhaps excitement and framing it in a way to optimize performance and attain exactly what we want, with a focus on the next step and goals. So those are a couple of things I wanted to add. Now, what else you got? What other thoughts or questions or comments do you have from our first seminar? Anything that you still are unclear about or want to talk a little bit more about before we move into our topic today?
Okay, this is Medea. If you could go over under the two additional aspects of change that may seem paradoxical, where you stated the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. I didn't quite understand that connection.
Okay. Whenever we have something that we've been doing for a long time, we've incorporated it as part of our identity. In fact, the most powerful force of the human psyche is that we return to our identity. So if we make a change, unless that's incorporated and internalized to revise the model of who and how we are, in other words, our identity, we're going to revert back to the same thing. So identity has to be the final step of change. We're going to address that in seminar 3. Now, what you're asking about specifically is, whenever we're invested with something, it's not only our identity, we have a personal investment. So if something ends up being wrong, it's sort of like a narcissistic injury. It's like, you know, how have we been doing it all this time, and now there's something better? So it can be perceived as an injury to self-esteem, and this is how we need to be appreciative of that and help someone frame it in terms of a growth mindset, of looking at possibility instead of problem, instead of mistake, to look at opportunity. So
okay, so then would they, so they would then have to work on basically their self-esteem first before they could move to the next step of change. So as the life coach, I guess I'm trying to see if where, what point do I stop at? So I realize that, you know, they need to work on the self-esteem. Am I supposed to go to that level with them too, or then that's when you move them on to the next?
Okay, let me try to answer that, because self-esteem is not something you work on directly. How do you help somebody with their self-esteem? The only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having an internal ideal and living up to it. So this
right.
is where, okay, this is where we need to be very clear with our clients so that we're both clear about needs and ideals, because the client meeting their needs and living up to their ideals in the pursuit of their goals is part of what makes all of them go in the same direction. So we want to clearly know the needs and ideals, values that a client has as we look at strategies and goals, and when all of someone is going in the same direction, that's dynamite. So there was someone else who asked a question at the same time as Medea. Would you say that now?
Yeah, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome. How you doing, man?
And I'm doing great. Thank you. You had mentioned last week that when we're working with folks going through the grieving process, that sometimes old scenes, old stories, old experiences can get triggered along with more present ones. How do we as coaches address that in the deconstruction phases without attempting to do psychotherapy?
Okay, that's exactly what we're going to talk about today, because whenever someone goes back into an old mode, or a time capsule, that's a state of mind. And when somebody gets an emotional trigger and immediately boots up an old state of mind, that content is not going to change. So that's where we need to help someone get grounded and centered to stay focused in the present to create what they do immediately, because as soon as someone gets triggered emotionally, instantaneously, they're in a time capsule. The content, the conversation is not going to change. If you ask somebody when they're emotionally triggered and they're in that experience, what is the age of that conversation? They will almost instantly tell you, well, you know, I feel like I'm, you know, 13 or 14 and back with my family. Or, you know, this is the kind of fit I had when I was 7. So that content isn't going to change. It's just a matter of getting present and staying there, and we're going to talk about that more today because we're looking at regulating states of mind. So the common theme here is whether it's conversational intelligence or whether it's resonating with someone's current experience, state always comes first, then strategy and story. So that's why it's important to really resonate with their state of mind, help them get current, because that's where this is coaching and not therapy or counseling, because we're looking at now and next, at the choice architecture of how someone decides in this moment, getting present in this moment. Does that, in a preliminary way, Kip, make sense to you?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. One other comment or question before we get into the material? If not, I'll move in and we'll have a bit of time in the end. So jot down anything you want to be sure we talk about at the end of the seminar. I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. Thanks for all the input and the questions. I appreciate it. Okay, we're going to look at how specifically to change mind, brain, and behavior. Because when you change not just behavior, but mind and brain, that's what makes it permanent. So first the question, why do we resist change? even changing a story that doesn't work. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will somebody repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and maybe even expect a different result? Even when it consistently leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default model. We repeat because we know how it will turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. On the other hand, a new story, doing something in a different way, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. There's that concept again. We tend to return to our default mode. Do a brief exercise with me. Put your palms together very firmly in front of your face and interlock your fingers very firmly. Now, notice which thumb is on top. Now keep your fingers interlocked exactly the same and change so that the other thumb is on top. Just reverse the two. How does that feel? Kind of awkward? Now move your thumbs back to the original place. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. Add significant stress or significant success, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. So, we're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is so difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which, whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn, despite it really being circuitous. No one started a new, more direct route. On subsequent days, no matter how many twists and turns, and it got increasingly diabolical, not a single person created a new path. Each person followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in our brains, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, new context, powerful questions, exactly what we do as mentor coaches. So, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed, or as intuition of a wrong choice, or it can be framed as a signpost of change and progress. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center of the brain that says this isn't normal when we try something new. same for change, same for transitions. So we're going to talk later about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So basically, we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. So I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients, regulating states of mind, never more important than at time of change and transition. So first, to understand states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information and then how we respond. A state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns, just like a software program, internally consistent. A key element of mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind and to focus on which state works best for what purpose. An illustration of how states of mind are like a different software package. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach the rat to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject a little bit of amphetamine, so you simulate kind of a stress-like state. You teach the rat to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. But with this rat, when you take away the amphetamine, it can't get to the cheese. It has in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can die of starvation in that maze and not be able to get there. You re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. Now, this is an example of how two distinct states of mind exist without overlap. It's really more analogous to something like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may not be remembered in the usual way. Or even multiple personality disorder, where distinct states exist without a seamless blending of moving from one state to another, as we usually experience in our ordinary lives. A common example is when you try to think of somebody's name and can't, you know it's on the tip of your tongue, you just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind, and you're not even thinking about it, boom, you know the name. It comes. A state of mind is a mind-body state like a specific software program, again, that determines how we perceive, process information, and respond. Each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. It's really important to become aware of which state to enter, for example, for a creative endeavor, which one to enter for conceptual planning, and what state of attention and concentration works best for everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. So here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Once we're tuned in to the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. When we are totally grounded and centered, we have full access to all the information in our states of mind. We have full access to our intuition, a way of knowing not processed through logic and usual means. Together, then, we can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations beyond where either coach and client alone might have gone. So, we need to allow this right brain engagement, this emotional connection with the client, to take in emotional communication, to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. And through the process of change and transition, a lot will be unexplained and without closure for a while. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's the way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and neuroscience of mentor coaching. So let's look then at how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing I believe we can do to achieve success is to manage emotions and regulate our states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of regulating their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning of what you perceive, and your meaning determines your behavior. So the state of mind, by determining the meaning we attach, the meaning determines the behavior, determines how we really respond in situations. So there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: focus and physiology. Physiology is how you use your body to change your state of mind, such as relaxation, deep breathing, meditation. Focus is what and how you focus on. From quantum physics and neuroscience, we know this. You get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns the energy field of your brain. So what you pay attention to determines your state of mind. Now, what we usually think about paying attention to is what we determine as most important. Your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. So ask questions that habitually empower you. Instead of, what's going to go wrong today? Why am I overweight? Why can't I get started on working out and better nutrition? Ask effective questions that determine your state of mind. This is the power of focus. Ask habitual questions that empower you. The best mentors, leaders, teachers, coaches are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our resources. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people want to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president at the time, John Sculley, to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City. Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So here's an exercise. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state, in an empowered state. Each morning, answer these three empowering questions and feel the answer. Now, remember, you're already asking questions, whether you're conscious of it or not, from the instant you're awake, before you ever turn on that bedside lamp. So try programming three questions that you're going to answer first thing before your feet hit the floor. See what results you get. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer to questions that will empower you. Now, let's look at applying the focus and physiology to regulate a state of mind. This is going to get to answering Kip's question in a slightly different way. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide of 217 teams. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. And a mantra consists of three things. One is a cue, and then a focus phrase, and a physiology. So, he suggested that as soon as they stepped to the free shot line, but before they shot the ball, their cue would be two dribbles, and at the same time, they have a focus phrase, and he suggested something like relaxed and smooth, and at the same time, they have a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So in 5 to 6 seconds, they would do this mantra and then shoot a free shot. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. Some of my clients who are pro athletes and actors have used it to get grounded and centered for their performance. And pro athletes are very conscious of managing states, probably like you are before you give, say, a keynote. A tennis player, a basketball player will anchor a state by bouncing a ball a couple of times before serving or shooting. So mantras can calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. It's something that you might consider before I accept any call from a client I'm mentor coaching, before I dial in for a teleconference with any training. I do a brief mantra. I want to be totally present and have access to all the information that I can possibly have. So let's look then specifically at neural conditioning. Whatever we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. So to change behavior, change neural association. Now, thinking positively is simply not enough. You can think positively for a moment, then you go back to what's already been established in your brain and the neural networks and connections that are already there. And whatever you know as a fact, whatever you have as a behavior pattern, whatever belief you have, that's an anatomical reality in your brain. And you don't change that by just suddenly having a better one and thinking it's going to overwrite what's already there. So what we're talking about now is how to change a software program. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe or know it's there. It's linked. What's your association to this? Winston tastes good. Now, if you're more than 25 years old, for 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been over 30 years since you've heard this jingle, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. So you can change your behavior when you change your meaning. You can reprogram associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, neuroassociative conditioning, is a process. It's not an event. You can't work out one time and be healthy for life. So a neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. This creates a link. Anchors happen when you're in a highly emotional state. Now, consider the two forces behind all behavior. And listen to this from the perspective, for example, if your client knows he or she needs to do something, wants to do something, has a plan, but then reports that they didn't follow through. There are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. This is biologically hardwired in our brain with the support program in our mind. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biologically more strong. It's contributed to our survival. Trying to create success by creating more pain usually does not work very well. In any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The pleasure of the cheesecake, especially the strawberry topping, is more enjoyable than the pain of the idea of being fat, because overweight's an abstract idea. Being in shape is a future event versus the immediate pleasure of the dopamine release at the anticipation of the cheesecake. Not of the cheesecake itself, but at the anticipation. Spending money in this moment seems like a greater pleasure than the later gain of money by saving or the later pain of avoiding debt financially and emotionally. Now, again, it's not spending money that creates the pleasure response. It's the anticipation of spending the money. To change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives a whole lot of human behavior. It usually, and this was done first in some very sophisticated studies that showed that it's about twice as painful to lose $100 as it is pleasurable to gain $100. So to influence somebody, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do and have a plan, underline that, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or the money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having it, even though it doesn't make logical or conscious sense, even though you would overtly deny it. With a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously, you may think that money equals pain. For example, all this effort it would take, well, I think I'm just as comfortable where I am. Well, you know, people would judge me. I'd be ostracized. Well, I'd kind of be lonely at the top. Or think about all the time it would take away from me for what I really enjoy or for my family. So here's the coaching application. If you have a plan and you're not sticking to it, then what is the pain that you're avoiding? That may be the shadow story. Remember that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So it may not make sense. It may not be conscious or logical or intellectual, but yet it may be there in a way that you're avoiding pain. So this would be the coaching question. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? What's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? We are defined by the stories we tell ourselves. So is your story empowering you, or are you creating an obstacle to fall short? Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? Which one is true? The one you pick will be the one you believe and live. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came maybe from 10 years ago or the one they want to believe. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. Think about this. What's the biggest addiction we have? The one that's almost impossible to give up or abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and allows us to escape our own fear. Our biggest addiction is our problems. Walk around at any cocktail party and you'll hear people's addictions because they've got their problems down. They've got those stories down. For any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. This is directly applicable in mentor coaching of change and transition. State management, again, is the most important aspect to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. Strategy is to move beliefs to behavior for successful performance. most people start with strategy, but strategy is an involved part of the process. So reevaluate your approach, your state of mind. That's the key element. Story is the organizer of what you do, the theme and storylines of what you're pursuing. For Martin Luther King, for example, his story was, I have a dream. So how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three key principles of neural conditioning. In other words, to rewire your brain, to create change and make it last. One, identify what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change something. Change it now that you can change it. Must, can, and will change. And to feel that not changing would be ultimately more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. That's huge. Believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. Change can be linked with pleasure. So here are questions for this first step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to the choice that you're now making? What will be the pleasure with changing? Two, you have to interrupt the existing pattern. The most common mistake here is that people add something to already existing patterns. It's kind of like adding a health club membership to all the other stuff you do. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. A pattern must be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. Remember, a fact, a belief, it's an anatomical reality, so you just don't add something on and expect it to override what's already there. You have to disrupt the linkage, the pattern, the algorithms that are already there for the existing pattern. So here's some questions for that step. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic behavior? And how can you interrupt the pattern once you've identified it? Now, I want to mention to you, this is a sidebar here, but I go into a good deal more depth about neural conditioning and changing neural conditioning on the home page of my website, Master States of Mind. There's a neural conditioning chart. It's a proven four-step system. It's a single page that you can work with your clients that is most effective in rewiring your brain and making that automatic. So I would highly recommend that as homework, as a supplement to what we're talking about, because we have a limited amount of time and I wanted to give you some things that can put that in its own framework. And the third principle, create a new association that empowers you. So after you identify what you have to change, interrupt the pattern, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you'll gain, the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, you're phobic about something. You link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. So here are some questions for this third step. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you want to bring about? Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you have with the change. You're probably familiar with this. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experience in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference that they survived. 24 out of every 25 focused on the suffering, on the instant death, the inevitable death. The people who survived developed a reason to survive, to transcend the immediate experience and create a meaning, a purpose for their suffering, rather than accepting their fate, wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so they could tell their story to their children or to make certain this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose, to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped pull them through the toughest of times. So, let's look for just a moment at mindset mapping for growth. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret and give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. Mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we tell the stories that we do, especially about ourselves. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the world. The human brain then operates much like a Google map. So you see a situation, you boot up a map to operate. When a new situation arises, new maps booted up. This explains how we have different contexts or frameworks for different situations, different states of mind or mindsets. These mindsets or maps are stored in our unconscious, the brain's focal point. A mindset is its own world, its own software system. It's complete. It's internally consistent. The mindset comes first. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach to a cue or stimulus. The meaning determines your behavior. So to change your behavior, you have to change the meaning you attach. So let's look at this in just a broad way, especially in terms of practical application for coaching. A simple example is a growth versus a fixed mindset. A growth mindset is based on a belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You're open to information about talents and abilities. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. So the growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved through life. The fundamental assumption is everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. This is what we coach toward. This is what so many coaching interventions are about, to convert a comma, convert a period into a comma so that someone considers more or considers different ways of looking at it. Now, consider a fixed mindset. People with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. They want to prove themselves. Each situation calls for confirmation of intelligence or character and repeated internal questions. Will I fail or succeed? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? A fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with these things. So these are some of the characteristics. Again, each of these are a moment for coaching. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how smart you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. So this is an application of one of the things that we really focus on in coaching, especially to catalyze change and transformation. Here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the 3-year period of study. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in this 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, and cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. So they lived into the belief they had or died into it. So to help clients change behavior, mind, and brain, some principles here, and this is in the outline. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Correct mistaken couplings to understand and build on existing networks. In other words, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So, give attention to new experiences or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. So, let's review some important element then to successfully mentor change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate your state of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left and right brain, intellectual and emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually tell when you have an inquiry that prompts insight versus a kind of subtle veiling of trying to persuade somebody to pick what you think is the right answer. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. We always get what we focus on. So we want to focus on the positive, and the positive not just as a reversal of the negative, because remember, the brain doesn't know negative versus positive, just the focus. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model, of the client in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new behavior, the new focus. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This helps create an overview, an outline, to incorporate the new experiences as a storyline and part of an evolving identity. This is what makes change permanent. When someone incorporates the change into the fundamental model of how and who they see themselves to be, their identity, because that's what they're going to return to, as well as that's what makes change permanent. Okay. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Thoughts or questions about anything that we talked about? Any clarifications first? Or any questions about applications of this that you have? Remember the,
yes, I have a question.
Okay, please, go ahead. This is...
Yes, this is Amelia.
Yes, go ahead,
okay,
please.
Yes, my question is how to create and how to incorporate this new experience as part of the storyline.
Okay, tell me your question a little bit more. How to prepare...
How do you help create a new identity? This is more mentoring than coaching, isn't it?
Okay, I think I understand your question. See if this answers it. I'm gonna give an answer that's important, and I hope it's gonna answer your question. This is something that we do in an ongoing way with our clients, is that we help them to internalize the process. We reflect back to them so that they will develop self-reflection, this mentalization themselves, this mindfulness of being aware of themselves, not just of their states of mind, but what they're thinking and feeling and experiencing. We are empathically resonant with the client, as we talked last time, in order to help them develop an empathy with themselves, so they will develop this mindfulness, so they develop this capacity even more so to self-reflect and to evaluate themselves. So as we're experiencing something that they're doing new, they're doing something new or different, they're pausing instead of reacting, we highlight that and indicate, you know, I hear how differently you're handling that now. Or I hear how you're pausing to reflect about what you're doing and consider what's the next best step. So what we're doing in that, when we're reflecting with the client and developing that capacity even more so, we're helping the client change the model of how and who they are, and helping the client develop even more so a mindfulness, to be aware of what they think and feel, and to create perhaps, for example, a contemplative pause between an urge and an action. That's where judgment resides. When someone has an urge and they pause for a moment to consider, what's in my best interest? What's the next best thing? That creates the possibility of judgment that's going to be in the client's best interest, because to fuse urge and action is an impulsive reaction. When they develop
right.
that, we want to highlight that. So everything that develops this quality of empathy, they're developing themselves, of self-reflection, of developing mindfulness, these are things that we're helping them do that will move toward seeing themselves in a different way, and this is basically the identity that we're talking about. Identity is sort of a conclusion from all of that. So
yes, it's claiming ownership.
I'm mm-hmm. sorry?
It is claiming ownership.
Exactly, yes, yes. And being able to reflect it and internalize it as part of their new and evolving story. So we're helping a client create a new story. And that's exactly what we're focused on in mentor coaching, is facilitating and catalyzing that story. The story is from the client's point of reference. It's their story, and their effectiveness, their mastery is in creating it, and that story is evolving how they see themselves and who they see themselves to be. So they have that story to rely on. That's what we need when we have a different mindset that's booted up like a Google map to a different situation. We want to be sure that we have a cohesive story where each of those mindsets make sense and we see the purpose for it, so we can select the best mindset that's going to work in this situation. So in one way of putting it, all we ever need to do in life is the next best thing. And this is a way to develop the capacity to assess and create this ongoing story of doing the next best thing. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much.
Sure, sure. Who else?
This is Medea. Hi. Okay, so I'm struggling with, I understand everything you're saying. This is kind of based off of the helping to create new identity, new story, new experiences. But what I'm finding with some people that I'm working with lately is the self-esteem issue being a huge barrier, meaning if you're trying to encourage and facilitate new behaviors or emphasize positive adaptive behaviors and progress, discourage attention to negative behaviors. But if the client is constantly, let's say, not believing in the outcome of what that new thing is, like we were talking about earlier, seeing the change as being something more positive than negative, or not believing that they can, that it's feasible to them, then I guess, are they not, because these clients are like in the beginning phase of change, just realizing like, you know, I need to make some changes. So they're not, so they really have low self-esteem. They haven't had the experiences to build up their self-esteem. And when I try to encourage the new experiences, it's like, yeah, but. So
okay. I want to interrupt you just because of time, because what I see for a question like this is what I think is the most basic thing that we do as mentor coaches is to really understand how someone constructs their stories, to look at the algorithms for behavior, for emotion, for patterns of attachment. So here, what I would look at, again, as I mentioned earlier, is what is the most fundamental element of self-esteem and someone developing a story? It's someone's ideals. What is their ideal for their behavior? What are their needs? And how are they incorporating those in a current context in a strategy and goal? So when someone incorporates their needs and their ideals to strategize and successfully reach a goal, self-esteem is a conclusion that they reach. It's not something you can give them or something they can decide to do. It's a conclusion. It's a dynamic result of having and acting on their own needs, their own ideals in a strategic and successful way. So that's why, in my view, the mentor coach needs to have a clear idea of what the needs and the ideals are of a particular client, to incorporate them to be sure that the client is using those to inform strategies and goals instead of doing something that may not be a fit. So this is when all of the client is going in the same direction and all of that fits, then effectiveness and mastery is the result, and the experience of mastery, the experience of self-esteem follows, and this is something that we highlight in reflection back to the client so it becomes incorporated as part of their identity. So mull that over, think about it, we're out of time, and see what you think about as you reflect on that. And for those of you who have, for it's about 30 or 35 minutes, the Master States of Mind on the home page of my website, MentorPath. I think it will be useful to you. And we'll pick up right here next time. I look forward to our next seminar. Thank you very much, and thanks for all of the input and energy and feedback. I appreciate it. Hope you have a great rest of the week. Bye now.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Could someone tell me the website, please? Hello?
Hello, I think he just cut.
Do you know the website? I think it was
MentorPath.
MentorPath, P-A-T-H?
Yeah.
Okay, .org?
He didn't say if it was .org or .com.
Okay, I'll try both then. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Okay, hello, Amelia.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
I think I heard him mention something else as well, so you might want to check both of those. Another thing he mentioned was Master State of Mind.
Master.
Right, I think that was from his website. What is
I think that Master, like to, you know, take charge of State of Mind.
State of Mind.
Yeah,
okay.
I think that said the neuro condition was there, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I'll try both of them. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah, if not, we can look it up by his name.
Look it up under his name, right, and then all of what he's associated with will pop up.
And
yeah.
We'll find the website. Yes, I think that we can look it up, you know, by his name. I'm going to try that tonight.
Yeah, me
did
too.
Did you guys get an email from him?
I didn't get an email this.
From when? In the beginning or recently?
Yeah, like
but
in
then,
the beginning. The beginning,
yes, I think.
Yep.
A product is in the email. Yes, I'm going to
check
the email.
Okay.
Yeah, because
I didn't
get an email, and I heard that in the first class he emailed people. I'm like, I didn't get an email.
Oh.
Cool. So for the first class, I think he sent the email in the afternoon, Monday afternoon.
Yes, I think so.
Right.
I didn't check it until later. Yes, I think so.
Is there anyone can forward the email to me? Because I keep missing
him. What is your
My
email?
My email is Live Creatively.
Live.
Live, L-I-V-E. Creatively. Creatively. C-R-E-A-P-I-V-E-L-Y. I-N-C.
I-N-C?
I at gmail.com.
Okay. At, INC, at?
Gmail.
Gmail, okay.
So it's Live Creatively, Inc.
Live Creatively, Inc. at gmail.com. Okay, if I find it, I forward it to you.
Thank you so much, Amelia. Thank you,
You're
guys.
Welcome. Okay, see you. I'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Bye.
See you next week. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.